from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Dave Eggers joined us in June to discuss his most recent book, A Hologram for the King. The author of six previous books, including the American Book Award-winning Zaytoon, which also won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, he is founder and editor of McSweeney's, a San Francisco-based independent publishing house. Also co-founder of 826 Valencia, a nonprofit writing and tutoring center for youth based in San Francisco's Mission District, with sister centers presently based in his hometown of Chicago, as well as in New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, Boston, and Washington, D.C. I asked Dave Eggers about the main character of A Hologram for the King. Alan Clay is a 45-year-old sales executive who goes to Saudi Arabia to sell hologram technology for a new futuristic high-tech city.
In this novel, he was in manufacturing most of his life. Well, he started as a Fuller brush salesman and then went into manufacturing at Schwinn, which the famed bike company that used to make all their bikes on the west side of Chicago.
So I had a Schwinn as a boy.
Yeah. I mean, they were built like tanks. They were fantastic bikes, and they were basically, you know, more or less handmade there on the west side of Chicago until the mid-'80s. And then, of course, they had some tried to bust up the union a little bit, and then they went to they outsourced things to Mississippi. Then they outsourced them to Taiwan and China, and pretty soon the brand sort of lost its way and was sold for a small amount of money to Trek eventually. So, and Alan Clay found himself sort of unwittingly or not, or you know, complicit in all of this, and he sort of finds himself adrift and out of a job.
Complicit, but then a victim, because he's kind of a latter-day Willie Loman in some ways. He goes by the old rules. He's an anachronism. He's even some really good jokes in here, by the way. One I wish I could tell on the air, but I can't. but the sense is that, you know, he's living with a smile and a shoe shine and doing all that those salesmen used to do, and it doesn't work in a digital world anymore.
No, he's, you know, this is a guy. When he meets somebody, he goes into old-time storytelling jokes, and he's not finding too many people that appreciate this. He comes off as antiquated and maybe even irrelevant. But you know, he goes to Saudi Arabia and he finds his guide Youssef. It actually is the first person in a long time that's appreciated that humor. But you know, his salesman rules, you know, which he has to have this constant veneer of optimism and happiness and levity. But I think most people at this point are either seeing through it or not seeing him at all.
Well, Youssef appreciates the humor, but those when he goes with Youssef to his father's place and says jokingly, "I'm a member of the CIA," it's taken very seriously. I mean, you're really sort of showing, well, a world of Saudi Arabia. You're opening it up to us. And, of course, I think many of the readers of this book, and I enjoyed the book immensely, would say, how does Eggers know so much about Saudi Arabia? And the fact is you were there, I guess, weren't you?
Yeah, I always do my research. I've been fascinated to go there. I mean, the whole book started with I have a friend who went to this, it's called the King Abdullah Economic City, about 5 years ago to sell IT. And anyway, the rest of the story is completely different than the novel, but I was interested in, you know, King Abdullah is making these cities in the middle of deserts, you know, right? This one King Abdullah Economic City about an hour north of Jeddah is just rising out of nothing along the Red Sea. And he's trying to prepare for a Saudi Arabia when the oil runs out. So these are centers of manufacturing and education and tourism. But, you know, when I was there, there were maybe 2.5 buildings constructed and a lot of hope and optimism, and a lot of the, you know, the money for the development had dried up. So there's a lot of people sort of standing there waiting for somebody else to make a move, which to me really sort of symbolized the state of the world economy at that moment.
So it could have been other places in Saudi Arabia.
Could have been anywhere in the world, I think. Yeah. There's places like this all over the place, and I think that there are American salesmen throwing Hail Marys in any part of the world trying to sort of make that one deal that might set them up. I mean, Alan's up against it. His daughter's dropping out of school because he can't pay her tuition. And
home's about to be foreclosed. Bad credit with Banana Republic. I mean, yeah, he's a man. You put him up a tree, really.
Yeah.
And how does he get down? Well, maybe by going to Saudi Arabia. But he does go to Saudi Arabia in large part because they feel he has a connection. He knows someone who knows the, I mean, he's related to the king, and that's how that world works, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, they say in Saudi, you really need to know a royal to get a business deal done there, and he knows a nephew of King Abdullah that they were sort of worked together maybe 20 years ago on a plastics deal. And so the IT company that he's working for, Reliant, says, well, you might as well send this old anachronistic guy to along with the team to see if that makes a difference, because without him, they might have no connection at all. And so he's this, you know, extra thumb, you know, with the team and walking around not really knowing if he's useful or not, but waiting for that moment when he could tell Abdullah, hey, I know your nephew, and hoping that that makes a difference. But most of the time, they're waiting.
So why you name, it's very Beckett-esque, in fact, waiting for the king that we get. And I noticed Beckett, first, as soon as you open the book, the epigram, but do you name him Clay intentionally? And I mean, names can be tricky, and I realize that, but I couldn't help thinking intertextually of a play you may know by Leroy Jones, who's now a Mary Baraka, called Dutchman. It's about a character named Clay, who is in Dutch, you know, I mean, because he's been molded and fashioned by the forces around him.
Well, it wasn't a reference to that play, and I expect you to always know more about these things than I do. But I do like the name Clay for that reason. And this is a man who's stuck in a way. You know, you have these nightmares where you're trying to run, but you're running through clay and your legs aren't moving, and you think that you're, you know, there's this illusion of progress, but you're not going anywhere. So I don't know, not to put too much on it, but I do like the name. And I think it's mostly Alan, and he's just this everyman name, and I tried to think of the name that would actually have as little content as possible. You know, you can sometimes overthink a name and put too much weight on it, and then every time you see it in a novel, you're taken away from the story because you're thinking about what the author's trick is with that name. But with Alan, he's a guy. He's this guy from Boston, from Chicago, and he could be anybody.
He's just what we used to call a regular guy, in fact. We're talking to Dave Eggers. His new book is A Hologram for the King. And a regular guy who, I want to talk about a few moments in the novel. But before I do that, I want to talk about what you do in the way of representing women. I mean, the whole sense of women having cell phones, for example, and the changes that are going on in Saudi Arabia is just starting to drive, and actually women who, in one instance he meets a Danish woman who invites him into a bathtub, and then later on he falls in love, I think, with this woman who is a doctor. And there's that whole sense in Saudi Arabia of things changing. I mean, she has him get in a pool with her, for example. I mean, there's a lot of water here with women. I don't know what women make of it. But, you know, I was just struck by that sense of you recognizing that things are starting to creep smally open up.
Huh? I think I talked to a number of women when I was in Saudi Arabia, and the women I met are incredibly well-educated, and there are opportunities for entrepreneurs. There are, you know, thousands of businesses owned by women, but obviously there's all these other Byzantine rules that are beyond belief. And the most visible being the inability to drive, and that's being defied every couple months. Somebody does a new provocation and puts it on YouTube, for example. And I think that, you know, there's a large portion of the population, especially the young and educated men and women, who want change and are really frustrated and exasperated. And they're having a little bit of a brain drain where these young, very well-educated Saudis have nowhere to go, nothing to do. So they leave the country to seek their fortune or opportunities elsewhere. So I think Abdullah is, you know, cognizant of this. And that's why some of these new schools, you know, there are co-ed universities here and there that are popping up that seen as a little bit of a nudge toward progress. But the women especially are both incredibly adept and genius-like at circumventing some of these rules and, you know, living a life close to what they want to. But then at the same time, they are, you know, incredibly frustrated. And you see a lot of women that are beyond frustration, and there's depression, and there's, you know, these worse. But I think that in this case, the women that we meet are very good at navigating those rules and getting some semblance of what they want. But of course, this is tied to class and money and education too. The wealthier Saudi women are better and more able to do that navigation. And but the country has obviously a long way to go.
So I don't want to give away much of the plot. Give away as little as possible. But do you give Alan a tumor on his neck so he can get a woman doctor's hands on him? Because that's what happens.
You think? Well, you know, this is a guy that's. It's been a long time for him since he's had any human connection, really. He was very unhappily divorced and is still very scarred from that experience. And I think hasn't waded back into those waters for almost a decade. And Zahra is the first woman that has, you know, that he feels a connection to. But it starts with him touching this area on the back of his neck that he presumes is a tumor that's slowly sapping all the life from him. And once the first moment she touches it, automatically it sort of feels better. She dismisses it, that it's nothing, and she'll get rid of it. And of course, that's for all kinds of reasons, he sees her as sort of a savior. And but of course, even that romance
I don't want to give away too much here, Dave. Dave Eggers with us talking about his newest novel, A Hologram for the King. But I was also struck by how difficult it is for Alan and for many of the characters in the book to communicate just on any level. I mean, he loves his daughter. He keeps trying to write to her to express his interior life to her and to communicate with her. And there's a moment in the book that reminded me. Have you read Paul Bowles? Do you know his?
Oh, sure. Sheltering the Sky is like one of my five favorite books ever.
Well, I was reminded of Sheltering the Sky, particularly because of the difficulty of the gap, the chasm that exists just in terms of communication with these Saudi workers and his not understanding them, them not understanding him. I mean, you were really getting at something fundamental there.
Well, that's, you know, the daughter's name is Kit, and that's a little nod to Sheltering Sky, which I reread every couple of years, and I like it more every time I read it, and it's so hypnotic to me, and obviously it takes place in the desert, and so I had to reread it when I was writing this. But, yeah, he's 5,000 or so miles away from his daughter, and they keep missing each other, and all he is left with is this basic trying to write a letter to her to express how he feels. And it ends up being sort of a confession of his own failures. And why is it that the one thing, especially a divorced dad like him, his responsibility is to send her to college. And she's played by every other rule and done what she's needed to do. And all he had to do was pay for it when she got into the college of her choice. And he can't do it. So as a man, and, you know, and as somebody that, you know, again, has a not such a good relationship with his ex-wife, the one thing that he's tasked with, he can't accomplish. And I think it's, you know, incredibly emasculating for him. And I think that he's struggling with that with Kit and trying to explain himself through these letters to her and maybe slowly coming to the conclusion that, you know, he put himself in this spot, you know, or did he? And how much is the tight corner he's in his own fault.
But he's a tragic hero, really, in many ways. Maybe not so much a hero, but really a tragic figure. And again, Dave Eggers is with us talking about his newest novel, which is called A Hologram for the King. And I'm glad to say wearing a Giants hat. I think last time you were here, you had a Cubs hat? I think maybe a Chicago with a big C on it.
Really?
I think so.
Well, I'm a little bit, I had that problem.
Well, no, but listen, maybe it was White Sox. It was American League. Not a National League competitor. You mentioned Sheltering Sky is one of the top five novels. You want to name the other four for you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I just made a list for the week, you know, that magazine. They make you mention a bunch of other books that maybe influenced the writing of this one. And I mean, those are the ones that are off the top of my head. And I mentioned in this list, I put Dangling Man, which is, you know, Bellow's
first
novel that man went waiting to find out if he's drafted, and which I thought it was really important to me a long time ago, and I go back
to before your time, 1947, yeah.
But it reads like it was written yesterday. I mean, so much of it. And Bellow, I think, still has that ability, that electricity on the page that's almost unequal.
Well, because you're Chicago-born, right?
I guess, you know, but, you know, really the novel I push on everybody is Herzog, and I have no idea why I have very little in common with his protagonist, but to me, every page, there's more happening and more sort of lassoing of all of life,
yeah,
on every page than anything else I know of. And so I met, you know, Dangling Man, I put on Sheltering Sky, I put Nausea by Jean-Paul Sartre just because, you know, this has a little bit of a...
There's a feel of that, yeah.
You know.
Existential despair and nothingness.
Exactly.
Those nice things like Beckett gives us, too.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, Something Happened, the Joseph
Heller's book. But that's about really the ad agency world, though.
Yeah, but, you know, as sort of an American businessman that feels like all of his the best years are past him. You know, he fought in World War II, and for what? The right to do nothing, you know, to sit in
the last good war, John Osborne called it.
You know, mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for naming those. And we also ought to get out of the fact that 826 Valencia is right at its 10th anniversary. I mean, congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah.
It's a milestone, a big milestone.
It's kind of incredible. It sort of snuck up on us in a way, but we started in 2002. And you know, the programs have grown pretty steadily, and we've been, you know, just blessed by thousands of volunteers that have helped us make all kinds of new programs possible. And we've been guided by the educators in the city who have told us how we can be useful. And I don't know, there's something every week that kind of astonishes me, the way that it's taken off in all these new directions and driven by the staff. And so
I mentioned, by the way, for listeners who don't know, it's a tutoring and writing center for youth, especially for underprivileged youth, and they're now in how many cities? I think I ticked them all off. Eight cities. In addition to the Mission District in San Francisco. And you've been doing so much, I can't say enough positive about the work you've been doing just in terms of literacy, in terms of college accessibility. And this was in many ways kind of an organic outgrowth of 826, wasn't it?
What?
The work that you've been doing, like on tutoring, and led to the desire for more college accessibility and work on literacy.
Well, everything about 826 was really organic. We started with just the idea that we would be, McSweeney's used to be part of 826. We would, the editors at McSweeney's sat in the back, and at 2:30 or 3, we would put out a sandwich board in front and say free tutoring after school. And then all of our editors and freelancers would become the tutors in the afternoon. And that was the extent of the idea. It was going to be very basic. And then it just kept growing and growing. And Nineveh Caligari came on as executive director, and she was a teacher in the city, and she grew it, you know, to its, exponentially more. And then as the kids start aging up, they start wanting to go to college. And of course you get involved. And, you find students that can't pay for college or students that need help with college essays or SAT prep, and so we design programs for them. And then we find that the UCs and the CSUs, you know, are getting more expensive, so we have to come up with, financing work for, you know, plans for them. So that's where Scholar Match, our college access.
Which we talked about with you, I believe, the last time you were on Forum.
Yeah.
And it's been getting a lot of support. It's been really... engendering a good deal of support, has it not?
Yeah, it's been doing really well. We are about to send another class of 40 students to college this fall, but it's tougher than ever. You know, like, it is a minefield. The way that the things that these kids have to think about and their parents have to think about is incredible. It's far more complicated than it ever has been before. Even just deciphering these financial aid packages that they get is so daunting, and we have to do so much hand-holding and one-on-one attention to that, and to, you know, helping with the families decipher these things, that I don't know, it's still I think it's incredibly difficult and very disappointing sometimes. Like, even when a student will get into a great private school, I had two of my favorite students drop out this last semester because they couldn't afford the loans anymore. They were seeing $22,000 a semester stacking up in their future and thinking, you know, they're theater majors at, you know, NYU or something. How are they ever going to pay this back? So they drop out. And so there's a long way to go, and we have to get even smarter about sort of where the students are going to go and going to be and leave school without too much debt and be able to actually start their lives. And this is like, I think, a national crisis right now.
Where it is a national crisis. I mean, there's more student debt now than there is credit card debt in this country, which a lot of people can't conceive. But again, you know, you're right down there in the trenches, and I commend you. I think it's also just not only an ongoing struggle and a challenge to find a way out of this morass that we're in, but also to find ways to, make public education simply more of a bastion. There was a piece you did a while back that I happened to see in the New York Times where you were saying everybody seems to be blaming the teachers. When things go wrong with the military, they don't blame, you know, the soldiers. They don't they don't blame the captains or the lieutenants. I thought it was a very good analogy, very telling analogy.
Well, you know, it's so easy to blame the teachers when we'll create these, I think, sometimes unrealistic and sometimes arbitrary goals for test scores. And we say you have to raise all of your test scores this many points within a calendar year or your jobs are on the chopping block.
Dave Eggers, his new book is A Hologram for the King. You know, I was just actually thinking, it occurred to me, I've read all of your work, I've read all of your wife's work and Vendela Veda, and to some extent, when you were talking about Sartre before and all, there's a little bit of a convergence here in terms of just that sense of a very different landscape. Turkey, Northern Lights, whatever, but also a world which has become, in many respects, one that the protagonist is struggling against in an alien environment.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I heard about this King Abdullah economic city, this sort of city rising from dust on the side of the Red Sea, it felt to me, you know, just the right place to set. A middle-aged man sort of looking back on his life and finding himself lost. And, you know, there's nothing better for an existential novel than an existential landscape like that, where there's only a few objects, there's a limited number of people. And the whole, you know, the landscape is so surreal. But, you know, he is in that place where, you know, is he completely responsible for his fate? Is he, does he have any agency at this point in his life? And
I can't help thinking of Bello again, you know, Augie March, fate is our character or character is our fate, you know, which is it? I mean, you're playing with that, aren't you?
Well, I am. I mean, I think that, and you know, you mentioned Death of a Salesman. Obviously this is a little bit of a, you know, it is a little bit of a successor to that, you know.
But forgive me, the real successor in some ways with Salesman, which we go back to Chicago again, was David Mamet's Salesman in Glengarry Glen Ross. He's not that kind of salesman. He's more the Willy Loman, isn't he?
Yeah, although,
you
know,
he's got some of that in him.
Yeah, you mean like the Jack Lemmon character? I'm sorry, I just saw the movie, so that's as close as I can come. I can't
Levine
remember
is his name. Yeah.
Yeah, where he just wants the leads. If he can just get a few more leads. I think that, Alan owes a little bit to him, but I think Alan is even further from that, you know, grasp. I think that Jack Lemmon feels like he's just within a few inches. If he can just get that lead, then he can make the sale. And if he, you know, but I think that Alan is further adrift. I think he's lost the map.
Well, he's not ruthless and unscrupulous. And Shell the Machine Levine, played by Jack Lemmon, is both of those things.
You know? No, you know, he's more of a guy that I think he's sort of, you know, I think that the state of, you know, where a businessman like Alan is in sort of an industry like the bike industry that he used to be in, it was a death by a thousand cuts. Like, he was part of the team that kept outsourcing the manufacturing and kept on sort of chipping away at the integrity of the business. And then suddenly he finds himself just as superfluous as the American workers that he, put out on the street. And I think that part of this time in the desert by the sea is him coming to some realization that, you know, that he's put himself in this desert, that, you know, he's the sum total of his small actions and the small decisions that he made, all that seemed like the right thing at the time, now have put him in this place where he has very little left.
Well, that's what I meant by a tragic figure, because traditional, classic Aristotelian tragedy, you know, the character comes to the realization in consciousness of what's led to his fate, as opposed to Willy Loman, who never really realizes what he's done or how he's done it. Talking again with Dave Eggers in his new book is A Hologram for the King. And by the way, 826 Valencia had a book that just came out recently with an introduction written by the great Ray Bradbury, who just passed away.
Well, this was my best American non-required reading class. We always ask an author to write the introduction to it. And this year, the students voted unanimously. All these kids are 16, 17 years old. One of them mentioned Ray Bradbury, and all of them said, yeah, let's ask Ray Bradbury. And he was 90, I think, at the time. He just passed away at 91. And I thought, okay, well, who knows if we can get Ray Bradbury to write the introduction. But there was a young guy named Sam Weller who works with him, and he said, okay, I'll have Ray dictate it. And so Ray from L.A. dictated this introduction, and he just turned it in a few weeks ago, and it's incredibly beautiful. And the kids were so moved that he had done it, and then he passed away, you know, a few weeks later. So as a guy from Chicago, Ray was from Waukegan, a few miles from where I grew up. He meant a lot to me growing up. It's also one of these things where you read him in school, and then I remember, like, in eighth grade, one of my teachers saying, well, he, you know, he's from down the way, and he's still alive. And that was the strangest thing. When you read this canonical writer, you can't believe he's still alive as a kid. And here he is all these years later having, you know, produced this great body of work. But he was the real deal. He was a true hero of mine.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum. Our guest was author Dave Eggers. He joined us to discuss his new book, A Hologram for the King. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny. Thank you for joining us, and Merry Christmas.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.